Hello, this is Thompson Smiley, and this is the next in a series where I take my Louisville magazine column called Smiley's Picks and go on air. And my guest today is Don Everett, who brings a number of skills to our discussion. We'll be talking about the upcoming performance of The Girl of the West, as it's now called, at Tinseltown and Stony Brook on Saturday. Saturday, January the 8th. To give you a little background on what we're talking about 4 years ago, the Metropolitan's new general manager, Peter Gelb, came up with what was described as a great gamble of relaying six operas live from the stage of the Metropolitan Opera to a cinema close to you. And in that year, 60 cinemas across the US joined in. In the season just ending, an estimated 2.4 million people worldwide watched nine operas in a staggering 528 US cinemas and worldwide 1,135 cinemas. Don, as a more than usually alert and aware member of the opera-going public, what does this phenomenon tell you?
I think it tells me that there are many more people that would be very enthusiastic about the operatic art form and have discovered what a fantastic experience it really is. And just from my own experience in attending these things, you can certainly understand that the live sending of this simultaneous sending of an actual live performance is unprecedented. And with, you know, thanks to wonderful technology, they're able to see things that probably a $900 ticket would not be able to afford them to see.
Yes. Close-ups and panning and all that.
Absolutely.
And what about the sound?
And the sound is absolutely superb, you know, and so one could go in all kinds of directions with the operatic purist. Should voices be mic'd or not mic'd? Of course, there's no question about this. They must be, and they're getting the acoustical advantage of perfect balance between orchestra and singer. You're not likely to get that even in a $500 seat or a $900 seat at the Met oftentimes, and so they're getting the best of all worlds, and I think the Met has really benefited from that, and so have the people. I mean, you know, it's just a marvelous thing.
Two arguments against what you're saying. One, some people say that it's not really reaching out to a new audience and that it's just the old, same old, same olds who subscribe to Kentucky Opera and also go to Tinseltown. And the other is that this technology threatens the regional opera companies. Take the first point first. Do you think it's reaching a new audience?
I have a mixed idea about that, because when I do look around me and my wife, we look around a bit when we're there, and we do see the same people coming most all of the time, and they would be probably opera enthusiasts that I have seen attending our own operatic performances here in the community. However, there are plenty of new faces of people who I think would not otherwise have come.
Young people?
Unfortunately, I wish there were more young people. I would have to say that the mean age still seems to be around 50.
Mm-hmm. I think that's charitable, but go on.
maybe it is.
Maybe 80.
but anyway, I think probably other statistics elsewhere may prove me wrong with that, or other people's findings might find that there are many more new people coming, or let's say people that would not otherwise attend opera in their own community. But at any rate, I think it is reaching to a certain degree a new audience. On the other hand, I think the statistics that I read from the Met would probably prove my theory wrong, because they have shown that their actual attendance for live performances have improved and increased as a result of this. So they must be reaching a new audience.
Yes, I think that's very interesting. And also, I think it helps their development activities.
Absolutely.
I mean, they're asking for donations nationally now. I must say, I find there's almost a spiritual component to it. You know, those of us who studied music and the background to theatre know that most theatre had a spiritual or religious or liturgical basis. And the idea that 2.4 million of us all sit down a Saturday afternoon, bow our heads and take part in this really international love fest, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And most especially for the recent performance of Don Carlos, which is a five-hour performance.
That was incredible.
And it was in a wonderful performance. And I found myself not even wanting to leave the theater when we had short intermissions. Because they,
same here.
Of course, they've done a wonderful job of appealing to the audience and showing them the backstage kinds of things going on that maybe the typical opera goer may not see. And they do such a charming and wonderful job of hosting those intermissions and interviewing the interviewing the singers and such. And I think it just adds a tremendous dimension of interest to the people. So,
and humanizes the piece, doesn't
absolutely,
it?
Absolutely.
I think there's a tendency, obviously, to think of opera as elitist and snooty and to think of the singers as the high priests of this cult. But the truth is they're as entertaining or more so than anyone else.
Absolutely. Yeah, I would agree with that.
Tell us a little about the Saturday's offering, The Girl of the Golden West. It was called in our day La Fanciulla del West. They now just call it The Girl of the West, or Minnie and the Seven Dwarfs. Have you sung in The Girl of the Golden West?
No, I never did sing that opera.
I thought you might have done Jack Rance.
No, I never did do Jack Rance.
Tell us a bit about it.
Well, I've only seen the opera a couple of times myself. I thought it was really, I have to grin when I think of Puccini trying to delve into the Wild West cowboy kind of a scene, and of all things, and I think you aptly put in your recent article in the Louisville Magazine, to cast Caruso in the leading role of the romantic cowboy is one has to use one's imagination. I think nowadays there are probably more choices to be made as far as casting is concerned. And of course, Deborah Voight, what a wonderful choice is Minnie. I mean, a beautiful voice and looks the part and is from the Wild West, is from California. Mm-hmm. Yes, she's a California girl and definitely knows what the West is about. So I think with American singers, quite frankly, it does bring a different dimension to that than European singers, that do sing perfect Italian. On the other hand, if we're, since opera has become much more of a theatrical kind of an art form than it used to be, perhaps in Caruso's day, I think not only perhaps, most definitely it has, the expectations of those very people that go to the HD performances are going to have some visual expectations of what, appropriateness of casting and
that's
such.
Right.
So these things, people will certainly embody the characters, I think, a little more believably.
It's a new age, isn't it?
Oh, it certainly is.
We were talking before we came on air about the evils of name dropping. So here goes. As Pavarotti said to me, if I were trying to get started again at this weight, I wouldn't make it.
Mm-hmm.
And Deborah Voight, of course, was hit the headlines once for being awfully fat and then again for being awfully slim again.
Yes.
She's been through this weight thing. But you've got a new batch of singers, haven't you? Netrebko, Desai, Kaufman, Flores, who are visually as...
Oh, absolutely. And visually so enamoring. And, let's not leave out Renee Fleming, who just happens to be one of my favorites.
Beautiful,
it is a day now where, the visual aspect is definitely going to be considered. I'm not sure that it really needs to be that there, or let's say, be labeled at the fact that there's such a large array of choice of wonderful singers, and so that if one has beautiful blonde hair and is figure that she's going to be taken over the one who sings more beautifully, but may not be visually as attractive. I am reminded, since we are dropping names, I'm reminded of the Met's first televised Otello, which at the first choice of that, they had James McCracken in mind, but along came the dashing Placido Domingo and was visually more enamoring, and lo and behold, in spite of the seniority Mr. McCracken enjoyed at the Met, they chose Domingo over him, and it was most certainly a visual choice. One could be contentious on one hand. On the other hand, one can certainly understand. I think it's a good sign in many ways. And I think young singers that are aspiring to be opera singers are faced with a different kind of situation nowadays. And it's a reality, too. I mean, the day of the obese opera singer, I think, is over to a certain degree.
And, yes. Yes, and people, of course, nowadays are so much more visually sophisticated, aren't they?
I think so, yeah.
They get most of their information from reality TV and and the movies. Mm-hmm. So you recommend then that we bundle up and head off to the Tinseltown or Stony Brook Saturday at 1 o'clock, I think it is, for The Girl of the Golden West.
As sure, we were still I highly it. Recommend it.
Thank you so much. My guest today is Don Everett. Thank you, Don. Hello, this is Thompson Smiley with our series of Smiley's Picks, a column which runs in the Louisville magazine once a month and which from which we now broadcast excerpts on WOL. My guest today is Mick Napier. Mick, is it reasonable to claim that you may be the most famous stage director ever to emerge from Hazard, Kentucky?
I don't know. I bet you that's possible, yeah.
Mick is in town rehearsing for It Takes a Vill, Actors Theatre's upcoming satirical show, which has its origins, I think, with Second City Theatres. Tell me something about that.
Absolutely. Well, Second City's been around since 1959, and we just celebrated our 50th anniversary. And we create sketch comedy, which is unrelated scenes, monologues, songs, etc. And we've brought a couple of writers down to Louisville to immerse into the culture here, learn all they can, and then we tailor make a show and bring it down to Louisville.
You're also famous, are you not, as a breeding ground for some of the great comedians. I mean, Bill Murray's name is bandied about, Stephen Colbert, Tina Fey, Mike Myers.
Yes, Stephen Colbert was in my very first class that I taught at Second City.
Was he really? He's come a long way.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He's a very nice guy, and he's a really funny person to be around.
Well, tell us something about the process then. You've two writers, I think it's Ed Furman and Tim Baltz, and
yes, Tim and Ed take it from there. They're two of the funniest people I've ever met in my life. They came down to Louisville and they met with all kinds of different people, organizations, bars, everything, drank with a lot of people and learned as much as they could, and then they go back and they sculpt a show that's tailor-made for the city, and we're very, very careful about not making fun of the city so much as allowing it to look at itself and paying tribute to it.
Yes, but at the same time, there has to be an element of comedy, an element of satire. And
absolutely. I mean, yeah, there is poking fun at it, but we're very careful to not be cocky and to go into a city and go, well, you know, here's how you're all screwed up. Yeah. We want to let everyone join the party and laugh at itself.
Yes,
if that makes sense.
And you see, it's a combination of sketches. You see, monologues, is a song and dance. Everything. I know it's been in preview at Actors, and it's due to open on January 6th, and will run through February 6th.
Yeah.
Tell me something then about the sort of people that Furman and Baltz met and talked to, or was it just an entire cross-section of the city?
It was. I think they talked to politicians, and I think they talked to bar owners. I think they talked to...
If you distinguish between the two.
There you go. And I was going to say religious figures, so I don't know if that crosses that spectrum also.
I think we'll leave that one for the moment. Move on.
Yes, they just talked to everyone they could.
Uh-huh. I mean, I'm not suggesting that the comedy writes itself, but there is something inherently comic in the human condition, isn't there? I mean, if I talk to you really seriously about what I've done with my life, it has a comic potential.
Absolutely. Well, every piece of comedy at least has to do with some semblance of truth. Otherwise, there's no empathy from the audience, and they won't be able to laugh at the common universality of everything that's going on. So you always have to find that common truthful element.
There's a line in The Yeoman of the Guard, I think it is, where W.S. Gilbert writes that for look you, there is humor in all things, and that philosophy is greatest, which teaches us to find it.
Wow. Well, I've never heard that. That sounds great.
But don't you agree? There's something, I mean, great tragedies are really great, you know, like Hamlet and things like that, but if you really want to delve the nature of the human condition, I mean, comedy should be your bag.
Indeed. I always feel like comedy desecrates something. It looks at some common truth, and then it kind of slips the rug out from under it in a weird way. I think that's why we would laugh at someone who slips on a banana peel, is that it desecrates their status. And I think that a lot of comedy does that. And at Second City, we're careful to do that in a very protective way because we don't wish to alienate our audience by being too subversive. But we do wish to have people look at things like, oh, wow, I never thought about that, and take away status sometimes.
Yeah. There's also a question of relief, though, isn't there? I mean, some psychologists have said that the reason we laugh at the fat guy slipping on the banana skin is because, thank God, it's not happening to me, it's happening to him.
Absolutely. I'm able to objectify someone else's tragic experience and laugh at it as a result.
Yeah. Only the Germans have a word for it, Schadenfreude, isn't it?
That's right.
Pleasure in somebody else's misfortune.
There's a group in Chicago called Schadenfreude.
Oh, is there?
Based
mm-hmm.
on that concept.
So you are stage director for this event. Have you been part of the writing? Has it? Were you given a finished script, or has it kind of emerged in the course of rehearsals?
I was presented the writing, and then we worked together to refine it. These fellows write a little long, so I have to cut some things down every once in a while.
Yeah, and what's the size cast? Is it
6?
Plus musicians?
6 plus one musical director.
It sounds very entertaining and interesting, and I think you're all pretty coy about describing which aspects of Louisville are going to be gently poked. I've seen one or two press interviews where they've been asking, well, are you going to make fun of this? And there's nothing leaking out of actors.
Yeah, I think we're a little bit restrained in what we're going to do. I can say that we're going to... I can say that we'll do some... We do a song about the mayor.
So I could say the new one?
Yeah, no, the old one.
The old one.
Yeah, we actually have the new one coming on opening night.
I'm sure you do.
And I think we're attempting to integrate him into a scene.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Does he know that?
I think he does know that, and I'm not exactly sure how we're going to do that yet, but we'll figure that out by opening. We do another song about Rick Pitino.
Uh-huh. So, yes, we do a whole opera on him.
Yeah.
A comic opera.
Uh-huh. So, yeah, we do this and that. It'll be fun. It's been fun approaching this because I myself have been so immersed in Kentucky my entire life. So I have 17 relatives coming the day after opening.
Great.
From Hazard, Kentucky.
That's great. So you'll get your discount. There's a discount for groups of 10 or more.
Oh, that's right. I think they did get a discount.
Yes, my wife belongs to one of these Kentucky families, you know, where, you know, if they all turn up at the theater at the same time, they get 10% off. I think it's 7 siblings.
Okay.
Yeah. So tell me more about the content then. Nobody says talking about this, but I'm glad to hear that our new mayor is going to be featured.
Okay, I can. We do a little KFC thing. What else do we do? We do a little derby thing. I'm being coy. I'm
now
being restrained. Yeah,
because
I'm looking over. Yeah, I'm actually looking over the running order in front of me, the order of the scenes, and I'm thinking I don't want to give away so
much.
No,
don't. KFC, of course, is a whole... I mean, there's a wonderful opportunity there for comic effect. When I arrived in Kentucky about nearly 30 years ago, the colonel had just died, and there was this huge funeral for him out at Kentucky World Headquarters, and the whole expressway was jammed with franchisees and things, and the then CEO of Kentucky Fried Chicken told me that they had intended to cremate him original recipe, but because of all the traffic jams, he ended up extra crispy. So
nice.
Even KFC tends to take itself less than seriously on occasions. Have you worked with Actors Theatre before?
Oh, no, I haven't. I was here to see a show, and I can't remember what it was. I was trying to remember the other day, many years ago, but I've never worked with Actors Theatre. I love it. I'm not blowing smoke, but it is one of the most professional theaters I've ever worked with. And yesterday we had a 10-hour tech day, and it could not have been a more professional and pleasant experience.
It's a wonderful organization.
Everyone I've met is absolutely professional and wonderful.
And, I mean, it staggers me to go out on a rainy Tuesday night or a snowy Tuesday night and go to that theater in the middle of February and find it packed to the roof. I mean, it's an extraordinary marketing achievement.
It is. I mean, I often wonder whether or not, I wonder whether or not Actors Theater realizes it's its own reputation, because it might be like, oh, there's some people coming from Chicago, but they might not understand that we are absolutely unequivocally honored to work there because of its reputation, because of all the people we've met there.
Well, thank you very much, Mick. The show is called It Takes a Veil, and it opens January 6th, running through February 6th. Go on the website, actorstheatre.org, for tickets or call 584-1205. Thank you very much, Mick.
Well, thank you. I've had a great time. Thanks.
Hello, this is Thompson Smiley, and this is another in our series of broadcasts of topics which I've raised in the Louisville Magazine under the heading of Smiley's Picks, and which we get a chance to air, perhaps, at more length here on WUOL. My guest today is Don Everett, and he brings us a large range of qualifications to discuss our next topic. He is, of course, an artist. He's also a professor at the U of L School of Music and an educator, and was for many years a distinguished opera singer in Germany. Then came to the United States and, to my great good fortune, sang for, oh, I don't know, 10 or 15 years with Kentucky Opera during my time. We're here to, I hope, to shed a different light on the ongoing issue of the Louisville Orchestra. We've heard from judges, we've heard from lawyers, we've heard from board members. There is, of course, a blanket on anybody intimately involved with the bankruptcy proceedings discussing it. But I want to talk to Don Everett as a regular audience member at the Louisville Orchestra concerts, but more importantly, as an artist, how he views this situation from the point of view of a working musician, of a working artist. Don, it must be a rather saddening time for you.
I would have to say that. Very, very sad. It's been a very bumpy road over the past several years, actually. I've been here 30 years, and there have been several junctures that have arisen just like this, where the orchestra's existence is being threatened, the players' contracts have been threatened, and yet they bounce back with great enthusiasm and provide very high-quality music-making in this community. And the other thing is that I know so many players in the orchestra as personal friends and colleagues over the last 30 years. And so I do have a certain, what should I say, perhaps bias in these whole dealings. Although I
bias towards the players.
Toward the players, of course. But I do I do think that this is a very important reality check at this point. And I think it all does, of course, come back to the contentious point, which has arisen several times, of should we go with 71 players, which has been the core and the nucleus number of players for the last 74 years, or should we diminish the number to 55 and use that as a core, and then the remaining, when large orchestrations are needed for Mahler symphonies and such. On the other hand, I'm reminded of a quote that was in the paper just recently that I think that really very aptly puts the finger on this situation. And I can't say that I have a solution to it, because I do know that from a practicality standpoint, it is an economic situation. And if we can't sustain 71 players, they can't pay 71 players, and they have to figure out a way to diminish the numbers. There have been downsizing and so many other aspects of our economy in terms of corporations and so on. I'm sad to see that it's also probably almost inevitable in the orchestra, but maybe not.
Before you get to your quotation, let me just correct one point of emphasis. I'm not sure the orchestra has been full-time for 74 years. I think for a long, long time it was a per-service orchestra,
meaning
you engage the number of players you need for the number of rehearsals and pay them a flat fee for 6 or 8 sessions.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I think it was only in the early 80s that we came up with this idea of having a big orchestra and having them on a salaried basis.
Yeah. I want to read a little bit of the section out of the Courier Journal. Please excuse my reading, but I think it more succinctly gets to the point that I'm most interested in here, and that is, it says, one exhibit that got a reaction from some of the 50 courtroom spectators was a part of an email message sent by the orchestra's immediate past president and current board member, Tom Noland, in addressing this the idea of reducing the number to 55 from 71. And he says, in addressing Mr. Berman and Mr. Mache, he says, I believe we will alienate just about everyone if we choose this path. I know the economic model of 71 musicians in Louisville is unsustainable, but we've unsustained it for 74 years. If we stop now, the wheels will fall off the bus, and very soon there will be no bus. And I think that's very aptly put. On the other hand, I can't say that it's an easy solution because it is an economic problem. I my heart goes out to these musicians whose contracts have been threatened time and time again, and yet they find it somewhere within their souls to bounce back with enthusiasm and with dedication and unflagging commitment to this wonderful musical organization that we have in this city that is a pillar and a nucleus and a core of any respectable urban musical community, and yet they're again threatened from this standpoint. So yep. My heart goes out to them.
Absolutely, and it was that aspect of it I'm most interested in discussing with you. But I mean, the fact is that very few, in fact, know. Urban conurbation, whatever you want to call it, no city of this size attempts to maintain a 71 piece orchestra.
Very good point, and that I have read about and I am aware of, and so therefore I will say that I think that might be the most practical solution. I can't say the solution of going to 55 players rather than 71. That particular problem, or let's say that particular discussion has been on the table many times in the past decade, and it's always fell on the side of the orchestra. Maybe, you know, and I'm saying this maybe with big question mark, maybe it's time for some compromise more on the player's side this time. I hate to say it, whether that can be accomplished with natural attrition and retirement and so on, one would have to see, I guess, and it's not something that I know enough personally about.
Nor do I, and I mean, one hears stories that there is, I hate to use the expression feather bedding, but some of the players work extremely, extremely hard every single rehearsal. Others are on salary and work far less, and I think there are tensions within the players as well. It's not a straight management versus the players issue.
Yes, I think that's true. It's a much more complicated issue than I really know about, so I really don't want to commit myself on one way or the other. I just will say from my own standpoint, my heart goes out to the players, and I think this community would, you know, if it comes to an impasse, I think and they choose Chapter 7 rather than Chapter 11, where all of their financial situation will be exposed anyway. I don't see that they have much of a choice at this point if they want to keep an orchestra going, than dipping into their endowment of $9 million. And when players know that there is that money available, and when the public knows that money is available, and yet it's said in a different way, in other words, it's presented that money is not available. I can see how a judge would say, "Well, you have your choice, you know."
Yes.
I hope they make the right choice.
The other argument is, of course, that the Louisville Orchestra management does not control these endowments. I mean, these are set up as separate corporate entities.
Right.
But we're not here to discuss.
Exactly.
We're not here to discuss the legalities. My great fear, Don, speaking as a friend and fellow toiler in the Louisville Arts Vineyard, is that if the Louisville Orchestra seeks Chapter 7, it won't come back.
Yes, exactly, and that's the risk.
That's what Nolan's talking about when he talks about the wheels coming off the bus. I asked Tom Nolan to come on the program, but he is also affected by the gag which the judge has placed.
Yes, of course.
I think is right. I think all of us who've been involved in any way working in the arts know what it is to know insecurity. When is my next job? Where's my next job coming from? Mm-hmm. But you think the players are experiencing more than their share of it?
I believe so, yes. And I think they have for a long period of time, as a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You don't see any obvious and immediate solution, not another Band-Aid?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't. In these times, it's very difficult. They've had the good fortune of having that in the past. You know, fantastic philanthropic people that have come forth with a bailout solution at the last moment. And I'm not sure that's it's obvious that it's not really always available, and they're going to have to find some other solution. And so, it's a difficult situation.
Mm-hmm. I think the important thing is for the musicians and the rest of us not to lose heart, because I think and be repetitive now, if the orchestra goes, it might be a lot more difficult to bring it back.
We have some precedents like the Detroit Symphony, where it really, you know, it's been on strike since October, and there's really no end in sight at this point. There seems to be no mediation there's mediation, but there's been no agreement on either side, you know. So that's the risk we will take, and I would hate to see that happen.
Don Everett, thank you very much indeed.